Welcome to the Commerce Tomorrow podcast, your one stop to learn about the technology that's powering the future of commerce. Here are your hosts, Dirk and Kelly.
Welcome to another episode of the Commerce Tomorrow podcast. I'm here with my co-host, Dirk.
Hi, Kelly. Hi, everybody.
And today we're really excited to be interviewing Andrew Hsu. He's managing partner and co-founder of Spotlight Analyst Relations. Welcome, Andrew.
Thank you so much for having me.
Could you give us a quick personal intro? I guess, how did you get into the chair you're sitting in today?
Yeah, that's a wonderful little journey. Yeah, so Spotlight Analyst Relations is a business that my business partner, Rick Nash, and I started about 8 years ago. We actually both came from the management consulting space, so digital consulting, the implementation side of sort of content and commerce experiences. So it was there that we learned how much that the analyst community could influence deals, how much they were counseling the Fortune 500 and making both technology and service provider decisions. So we learned about it there, and when we decided to start a business, we went down this path, and we've been at it for a little bit.
Maybe for all the listeners who are not that deep in the industry, can you explain to everybody what an analyst firm actually is doing?
Right, absolutely. So, analyst firm, it's a dangerous word, right? Because it can mean so many different things. Financial analysts, obviously a reserved term. What we're talking about are industry analysts. So, the folks at firms like Forrester and Gartner that cover the enterprise technology space. So they have these analysts who have a responsibility for covering a beat, for understanding all the different technologies and challenges that are in a specific space. And they author research that helps companies solve those problems.
So, and now related to, so this is what the analyst firms are doing. So can you tell us a little bit more what Spotlight is doing then for companies and how you work together with these analysts?
Absolutely. So Spotlight, we are a dedicated analyst relations agency. So this is all we do. So no PR, no IR, none of the related and ancillary sort of functions of comms. All we do is help technology companies and service providers that want to create a tighter relationship with these industry analysts. So folks, obviously, as you guys well know, analyst relations is a little bit of a niche craft, and not everybody is an expert within the space. So companies hire us to build those relationships with the analysts, to make sure that they have their fair share of coverage in the research, and that they are represented well and positioned appropriately in the waves and magic quadrants, the valued reports. So obviously, the degree of expertise is different at different firms, but those firms that need a little bit of help call us.
Yeah, absolutely, and it's what you already mentioned, right? It's relationship building, and relationships take time. I think that's also what we see, learned, and do over the years. It's not a take, right? So if you want to work with them, this is how I think we see it, is that it's not just a take, it's you also need to give, right? And as in every relationship, and there's a lot of stuff that you need to build. I think this is how we see working with these companies.
Absolutely.
And what are some of the top analyst firms, and where do they fit in the market? So obviously everybody knows about Gartner and Forrester, but you know, are there any other upper tier firms, and where do Gartner and Forrester and the rest of the firms have their spaces in the market? What are their different niches?
Sure, absolutely. So you do have these other firms out there as well. So you have the IDCs of the world and the Omdias. There are many. If you look at the size of these different firms, and I apologize, I'm just going to hop in a little bit on the profiles of them. You know, you take a look at the Gartners and the Forresters, they have a tendency, and the IDCs, they have a tendency to be the giants industry. The moment that you go below the secondary tier, which is the Omdias, the IDCs, the Forresters, you end up with thousands of smaller firms, hundreds of smaller firms, tertiary firms. So it's an interesting industry where the top folks, they control a disproportionate part of the conversation. So that's the Forresters and Gartners of the world.
And is that just because some industries are more prone to having a couple leaders at the top, or is it more of just that's the only two who are proving their value in the marketplace?
You know, it comes down to sort of necessity, right? So every single analyst firm finds their own little niche. Take IDC as an example. They have a remarkable data set on buying trends. So if you are an enterprise technology company that's selling hardware, if you will, or selling software, and you want to know how much of something is being bought in any specific geography, IDC is the winner. They have remarkable insight into who's buying what and where. So they found a specific data space. If you take a look at this council around like commerce tools, as an example, in the commerce space, you're looking at web content management, digital experience. What ends up happening is that there can't be that many companies where the Fortune 500 will call, right? They can't afford subscriptions across all the different firms, and nor would they want to. They just want to rely on a handful of experts. So I think over time, what's happened is companies have had to, these analyst firms have had to pick a major, and in our space, Forrester and Gartner have picked theirs first, and they've dominated. That's dominated the conversation.
Yeah, that's what we see is really Gartner and Forrester, those right. top two. And if you look at the commerce space a little bit more specifically, we see them, those two really dominating that market. Can you tell us a little bit about Gartner and Forrester's business in terms of employee count, analyst count, industries covered, where they're headquartered? You know, I don't think a lot of folks know very much about the background of these organizations. And I have to admit, I don't really either.
Yeah, absolutely. So it's interesting, right? There's a ton of history being written out there. And surprisingly, the wiki pages are useful here. But if you take a look at Forrester and Gartner, and I have a tendency to use them sort of exchangeably and say that they are the top two within our space. But the reality is that Gartner is a significantly older and larger organization. So if you think about it, Gartner has about 15,000 employees and Forrester about 1,500. So it's about 10x. That is reflected in the revenue as well. Gartner is pushing just over $4 billion, and I think that Forrester is just under $400 million. So revenue-wise, employee count, they are dramatically different. If you take a look at the analyst count, those people writing research and have the primary responsibility of counseling buyers and business leaders, Gartner has about 2,000. I think Forrester about 400. So it's only 5x difference there. So 5x difference on analyst count, but 10x in revenue. So it makes us feel that the coverage-wise, if you take a look at the commerce arena, the coverage is roughly similar, right? Same amount of coverage. They both write evaluative reports. They cover primary and secondary technologies in the space. But if you look outside of this specific category, Gartner is much, much bigger than Forrester.
Let's talk a little bit about the financial model here. And I think we can clean up with the misunderstanding. Later on in this episode, I know Kelly and I, we will have a few questions for you, Andrew, that we'll talk about. How do I improve my positioning? How do I have to work with the analyst? How is the process looking like? But for now, I think as a starter, many companies think I just throw over a bunch of money and then mm-hmm. I get my top spot in the Forrester Wave or the Gartner Magic Quadrant, right? So this is the main thing where everybody wants to be on the upper right kind of corner. And I know it's not working like that on the one end, and it's also not that easy that you just throw over some money and then you can buy your dot, right? Uh-huh. Maybe we can start by how do Gartner and Forrester actually make some money to help cleaning up this misunderstanding? Because I know a lot of startups are watching here and or listening in and definitely want to learn, okay, what can I do long-term to be well-positioned? So let's talk about the commercial model.
That's a great question. And honestly, that misunderstanding drives a significant amount of frustration in the marketplace. And we'll talk a little bit more about it later. But, you know, why are the biggest companies always seem to be leaders? Are they the ones with the biggest paychecks? Is that the reason why they are in the upper right? But if you take a look at their revenue models, first and foremost, both of these firms are rooted in the syndicated research model. And what that means is the analysts are experts. Those experts talk to people in the marketplace in order to gather data. They reflect their learnings and what they know about the marketplace and their wisdom and their opinions and what they spot as trends inside written research. And that research is available online behind a paywall. The primary driver of the revenue is the Fortune 1000 or technology companies buying a subscription to Forrester or Gartner, and that gives you the right to read the research, to see the written wisdom. And should you have questions about what's been written down, if you want to get more clarification, if you want to hear more what's behind the scenes, you can call that analyst who wrote it and have a conversation about that. That's called an inquiry. So this combination of being able to read the research and the wisdom and the ability to talk to the analyst about it, that combination is what we call a seat. So Forrester and Gartner's primary revenue source is companies buying seats to, in order to have access to the research as well as speak to the analyst itself. So that's the core of it. Then, of course, beyond that, they have other things like consulting revenue. They have event revenue. They have reprint revenue, so on and so forth. So, but the heart of it for both these firms is in that core of, I take money in order to become an expert in the space, and for you to have the right to ask me questions about the things and the things that I write. So the way that they see their core responsibility is for brands, right? So for retailers, for CPG, for healthcare, for financial services, for those big brands, how can I counsel the decision makers in those companies in order to see the threats that are coming down, to understand the problems that they're trying to solve? And then what we care about a lot on this call is, and to make great buying decisions. What are the technology available in the marketplace that I need to consider in order to solve this problem? So that's what they mean to the brands. On the vendor side, right, for the ISVs, for technology companies, they view their responsibility as counsel. They want to make sure that you are informed, that your go-to-market is strong, that you understand whether your pricing and packaging is competitive. They want to help you, give you counsel on what are your prospects talking about? What are your customers telling them? So they want to help technology companies build better products and be more successful in the marketplace. So they serve both sides of the coin.
And on the brand side, who typically has the name seats? Is this like the C-level execs, or are these more the hands-on practitioners who are, you know, leading, RFP processes? Or I guess, who typically are these analysts firms selling to within a brand?
You know, that's a great question. That's actually been shifting a little bit over time. So I'd say historically speaking, right, if you take a look at where Gartner came from, and the reason I'm honing in on them is because they were sort of the pioneers in the space. The majority of people who owned the seat were director level, maybe the highest level person who had hands-on responsibility for implementing technology, right? So it's that person who had that responsibility. So it was somebody who was who had enough visibility to look at the problem and then had a responsibility for implementing the solution. So that's sort of like where the who had it before. But now what's happening is that you take a look at both Forrester and Gartner, they're trying to up-level their game, right? So they're trying to go from the hands-on practitioner doer side all the way up to the leadership side. So now that each of these firms is pushing hard for the executives, the C-suite, to have access to a different kind of seat, something much more strategic, something a little bit more higher level, something more trend-oriented. So essentially what's happened is it started in the middle, now it's going up.
So they're moving almost into strategy consulting, like a McKinsey or Bain type of role then for some of these organizations.
Absolutely. Now, the question really, of course, is it's difficult, right? Those McKinseys and Bains and whatnot, they've been doing that job for a long time. What the Gartners and Forresters have that maybe the Bains and McKinseys don't have is they have a wider swath of data because they spend so much time listening. But it'll be interesting to see over the next few years whether Forrester and Gartner are able to be successful in counseling or taking some of the mind share from those consulting firms.
Yeah, makes sense. And let's look at the analysts, because I think the analysts are really the heart of this whole ecosystem.
Right.
So what role specifically do they play? And a related question is, what's the typical background of an analyst?
Right.
So what's the profile? What do they look for when they hire someone into that role?
You know, it's interesting. So the job itself is a little bit varied, right? So an analyst is, you know, the way that I think about it, it's some combination of a journalist, somebody who covers the hot news in a particular marketplace, an expert, right, a subject matter expert, because they have to know the technologies deep enough in order to make a call, as well as an academic, somebody who is trying to create evaluative models to say, is that better or is this better? So they're researchers, they have to cover all these different grounds. As such, what ends up happening is that the analysts come from different backgrounds. You have some of them come from academia, people who are professional researchers, right? They look at data, they're used to creating evaluations, they're used to looking at that data and making a call regarding scoring or trending and things of that sort. But also many of these analysts come from industry itself. So they come from either people who were leaders, consultants within the vendor space, or people who ran digital marketing in our particular case, or ran a commerce technology at a brand. So I've seen a wide range of different people come in, and naturally they have different skills and strengths. But if you take a look at what role they play, it's easy for us who are constantly inundated in our space, where we're just like, hey, we know this backwards and forwards. We live it. But the fact of the matter is, if you take a look at enterprise technology, some of these things are only re-platformed every 5 to 10 years. Obviously, that's shrinking these days, right? That timeline. These brands are only making this buying decision every so often. There's no way they can keep up with the intricacies of who has the newest tool, what's the shiniest object, what's the trend that's coming into play, what should I be scared of, what should I consider? So what the analysts play is a guide, right? You're at a Fortune 500, you're going through, or Fortune 1000, Global 5000, you're making a buying decision, you want to know, what's the problem? How have other people been solving it? What should I consider? And who should I consider? And those analysts serve as Sherpas and guides through that problem-solving process.
Very cool. And what, I guess, related question. So if you look at the analysts employed by a given firm, how does that firm judge the performance of a given analyst? Is it how many inquiry calls they have? Is it how many times they're requoted in press? Is it how much money they bring in? Like, what's the, if I'm an analyst, what's my game? How do I look good compared to my peers?
Right. In that way, this is where the sort of independence comes into play, right? So metrics are remarkable. What's a saying that says, the funny thing is that people behave exactly as they're incented? So... and that is so true.
Coin operated.
Yeah, right. If you tell, yes, a great question, which is like, if I walk in with $1 million today and I give it to the analyst, can I buy that revenue? Can I buy that that upper right hand placement? The answer is no. So the way that they're evaluated is how helpful are they, right? And the way that, and how influential are they to the marketplace? The proxies for that, the metrics that they look at are obviously readership. Who's downloading these reports? Who's looking at their research? And then the inquiries. Who's saying, I would love to learn more? How often am I talking to different people? At no point are they being incented by the amount of revenue that they bring in, right? So the sales teams and the research teams are dramatically, there's a wall between them, and their tendency is to keep the metrics very, very clear. So the analysts are measured by how helpful and how often they're helpful and how often they're read and how influential they are. And then the sales teams are generated based on how much revenue that they have. So the salespeople, no matter whether they can get that $1 million check out of you or not, can't influence the point itself.
So I have a question that goes into another direction, and to some degree, I also probably have at least one answer to that, because before our recording here, I had a call with Brian Walker, former analyst of Forrester. So, let me give you my question, and then you see where I'm coming from. So, what do analysts typically do after their analyst role that they had? So where do they normally move on when they leave their firms, right? And so I have the answer for Brian, but maybe you can give a little bit broader context to it.
Absolutely. So what ends up happening is that as analysts, you end up touching so many different people. So it depends on which side ends up drawing you in. I've seen it in all three different ways, and I'll talk to you about them. The first one's obvious, right? You talk about Brian itself, which is, I have been counseling technology firms and evaluating for them for such a long time. I see people make poor decisions regarding the product. I see them making good decisions regarding the product. I see them successful. I see them not successful. I think I would like a hand at running product in helping a company be successful in the marketplace because I feel like I understand it and I want a shot at actually driving rather than grading. So you do see a significant amount of analysts who eventually can't resist the siren song of going to work for a technology company, right? The other side happens is they end up talking to the vendor side. I'm sorry, the brand side, right? They talk to marketers and technologists and strategists and at these brands and like, you know what? I would like to take a chance at running e-commerce at Target, right? I want to go do strategy at, you know, you name your company that's out there. I want an opportunity to help a firm on a day-to-day basis. I want to fully immerse myself in their problem set, and I want to help them win in the marketplace.
Yeah. So basically, walk the talk, right? So
putting
things in reality that in the past had been mostly strategically for them.
That's exactly right. They get to take all their models and bring them into the brand itself to try to implement it. It's almost like I've counseled you before. I would like to put my expertise to the test. And then finally, that what happens in a but at a much smaller level is we have seen analysts go into press. So they become leaders in the industry itself. So I want to go run Shop Talk. I want to not just counsel the community. I want to bring the community together in a broader way. So that happens too.
Okay. So let's step back. So before they leave the analyst firm, how does a typical day of an analyst look like? Is there a typical day?
You know, it's it depends on the firm, but roughly the same. It's incredibly hectic. I'm trying to think through. Okay, so take a Gartner analyst as an example. The folks on this listening to this podcast may not know is that every Gartner analyst is required to block at least 4 hours a day on their calendar that's available for inquiry calls, right? These are 4 hours required to be made available for 30-minute calls with the customers of Gartner. So that already defines their day. So half of their day is done. The rest of the day is working with their agenda managers in order to determine what direction they want to go. The rest of the day, Forrester and Gartner and otherwise, it is about writing research, right? Working with their peers to double check that research. And then what they'll also do is they'll take briefings. So it's amazing how intellectually curious these analysts are. They wake up in the morning and they're like, hey, listen, I need to know everything about my marketplace and I'm only as good as the things that I can hear and listen and learn from. So what I hear from, you know, these analysts don't make money for taking briefings, right? They don't wake up in the morning. There's no metric that says, if I take in this number of briefings where I talk to a vendor in the marketplace or I talk to somebody who's implementing a particular solution, they don't get paid for that, but they want to hear what's happening. They want to know what's going on out in the marketplace. They want to see the emerging technologies that are coming into the space. So their day is pretty much broke up and up into, I have to field the calls I'm responsible for. I have to squeeze in my research and writing and that process of not only doing the writing, but also collaborating and fact checking. And then I have to hear what's happening in the marketplace from as many perspectives as I can. So it's the briefings, it's the writings, it's the inquiries.
And, you know, let's ground this discussion a little bit more. So we've talked to, you know, a little, at a higher level, what the role of the analyst firm is and the analyst. Many only interact with analyst firms and know them through their two reports. And again, let's focus on Gartner and Forrester here. Tell us a little bit more about the Magic Quadrant and the Wave. So why do they exist? What are they evaluating? And how are they evaluating the different vendors, right? Because they have an X and Y axis.
Right. You know, I think it's interesting because the reason why people know these waves and Magic Quadrants is because these evaluative reports get more reading by multifold. It's geometrically more attention to these pieces of research than the other pieces of research written by the analysts. And I think it's just because, you know, us as human beings like simplicity, right? I want to be able to see on a single page who are the people that matter and what are the relative positioning to each other. The reason why they exist is because each analyst who covers a beat, right? Take e-commerce, content management, advanced analytics, endpoint security, whatever their beat is, whatever their area of expertise is, they want one singular evaluation that says, hey, if you are a buyer in this space, take a minute. If you need, if you want to start somewhere, start with this report. Here are the people that I think you should be paying attention to, right? At least that in a way that I can have the time and energy to cover. These are the strengths that they have. These are the cautions that they have. This is who they are best for. And here's their relative positioning on a easy to read grid, right? And that's sort of the intention, but it's sort of interesting, right? So let me answer that question real quick about the X and Y axis first before I go into some of the different challenges with the tool. So taking a evaluative report, Forrester on the X axis, the bottom left to right, I think it is the strategy. So do you have a strong strategy or do you have a weak strategy? On the Gartner Magic Quadrant is completeness of vision. Do you have a complete, do you fully ascertain and understand the marketplace, or are you relatively niche in your understanding of the marketplace? On the y-axis, Gartner is ability to execute, and on the Forrester y-axis, it is a current offering. So think about it like on the vertical, it is what do you have available today, right? And the x-axis, which is what's your understanding of the overall market, and what's your vision for the market? So the challenge for this, what makes this awesome is because it's one single tool that allows people to see the marketplace in a quick view. But the challenge is that it's the evaluation criteria doesn't necessarily take into account the specific business problem that the buyer is looking for. So in that particular case, the analysts are always saying, hey, listen, take a look at this, but come and call me, right? Come and call me if you really have a question about it.
Yeah, that makes sense. Can you walk us through the process for actually creating one of these reports?
Yep.
So, you know, from end to end, both from a brand side, but also from a vendor side, you know, what are they looking at? How does the process work? How long does it take?
Yep.
You know, what are the nuts and bolts?
So the evaluation is relatively time consuming. Both Forrester and Gartner follow a relatively consistent model, which is, first and foremost, there's this, hey, qualification criteria. I want to take a look at the marketplace. I'm going to see who will qualify for this evaluation. The qualifications typically determined based on two primary things. One, are you a meaningful brand in the marketplace, that meaningful solution that everybody should know about? Or are you someone with so much momentum and you're a hot technology in the space and you warrant covering? So it is incumbency and then market momentum that are drivers of qualification. After that, and they've narrowed it down to who should be in this, they go through the process of sending you a questionnaire. The questionnaire is relatively straightforward. It is things like, what's your company size? How much revenue do you generate? How many employees do you have in the space? Both of the firms have different evaluation criteria. And it doesn't feel this way. It really doesn't feel this way. But the people who run these evaluations are always trying to take into account what's the minimum amount of stuff that I can ask in order to make a good grade, right? So, and I know so many of you who are listening to this podcast have been frustrated before because it is time consuming to fill these things out. But I know for a fact that the people writing the evaluative reports are trying to be fair, and they're trying to be detailed enough, and they're trying to eliminate the questions that are superfluous. So that's the questionnaire. Then what happens is there is there's a reference checking process. So you have to provide a certain number of references, and that differs based on the analyst and the firm. Because what they want to do is have a written submission where you answer a number of questions. They want an executive briefing and a demo that says, let me show you what I told you. I know you read that thing, but I'm going to show you what I told you. And then I want you to talk to references so that I can prove that it's real, right? I'm going to talk to somebody who's actually implemented it. From there, they'll go through the writing process after the evaluation. They'll send out a courtesy preview, right? Something that you can take a look at how you did and how they graded you and whatnot. You have an opportunity to provide factual corrections if they've got something wrong. This is when things can get a little contentious, right? Because people are saying, hey, listen, you gave me a 1, I think I deserve a 5, or you wrote this about me and I don't think that's fair.
It's funny, we're going through that exact process actually right now. This morning I was responding to an email on that. Yes, sorry.
No, I think it's such an interesting thing. And by the way, if it feels emotional, I suppose it is, right? I mean, this is an evaluation on your firm, your love, your the pain and that and care and effort that you put into. I mean, these things are incredibly, it's just an evaluation for the analyst, but it's incredibly personal for the vendors. So the rebuttals can get a little heated. I found that most analysts are willing to listen. If you provided facts before in the past and they simply looked at it wrong, they'd be willing to open their eyes. What they won't change is their grading scales. What they won't change is things that they're like, hey, listen, your customer told me this, right? There's no, I can't make a modification because frankly, your clients told me they either didn't use it or they weren't happy with it. So those are some things that you can argue and some things that you can't. And then finally, after you've gone through the whole entire fact-checking process and all that's happened, then you go through publication. At that point in time, you can negotiate all your different reprint rights. And you can say, you know what? I like my position on here. I'd like to market that. I'd like to have an opportunity to tell the world that I was included in this evaluation as one of the top 10 or 15 vendors in the world. And I would like to share that with my prospects. So from beginning to end, couple of months, you know, for the actual authoring process, it might take a little bit longer for it to get out. So it's a time-consuming process.
So Andrew, let's. I have a question to the scoring you just mentioned, right? So you say, okay, you get a one, you think you deserve a three, and so on. So how much on this whole questionnaire and the process of assembling a wave or a quadrant, how much of that is up to the interpretation of the analyst, and how much is purely relying on the facts and data that had been provided in the questionnaires and data sets you provided? So in other words, how much is depending on qualitative arguments versus quantitative factors?
Right. You know, it's such an interesting thing, right? When we're trying to evaluate technology, these analysts are put under a tremendous amount of pressure. They try to be as quantitative as possible, but recognizing the fact that a significant amount of these evaluations still has a qualitative aspect of it. They have to make a judgment call. Now, all of them are trying to see through the marketing speak, so they all have different ways of trying to go through the evaluation process. Like, how strong are you? Now, some of the things are relatively straightforward, like company size, revenue, how much revenue do you generate from a specific area. That stuff's self-reported, and they're definitely going to have to take you on your word regarding some of the different metric elements that that you're reporting. As far as your relative strength is concerned, I'm really good at this. This capability is really strong. They're making a judgment call, right? They're seeing multiple demos and saying, I think that this is easier to use. There's an incredibly qualitative element in there. But beyond that, what they do is I've seen analysts go more and more relying on the conversations that they have throughout the year with different customers and prospects, as well as their reference calls. So they're leaning significantly on those calls and those references in order to have a secondary opinion on the claims you make in either your spreadsheet submission as well as your executive briefing.
Mm-hmm. And how much of the whole evaluation is on the product versus being on the company itself? Because I think there's at least some differentiation, right?
Right, exactly. It's a little bit of both, right? But Forrester and Gartner both try to take these things into account. However, they go slightly differently. So if you take a look at the evaluation criteria for a Magic Quadrant, Gartner immediately declares, hey, listen, I care about things about your company. I care about your market positioning. I care about not just your offering. I care about your strategy. I care about all those things that are not just the product they're evaluating itself. It's also whether the firm they believe in, right? Is it heading in the right direction? Do they have the right momentum? Are they using the right words? Do they understand the customer well enough? So and that's reflected in the Magic Quadrant and the fact that all the dots are the same size. They're saying, I've taken into account the vendor itself, and then what I've done is I have reflected that in their placement. Forrester goes slightly different. They have a tendency to focus a little bit more on the product itself, so the offering. I'm really honing in on, does this particular technology solve the problem best, right? So they're looking at, does the technology solve it? And then what they have is they have like market presence. So how big is the company? How much market share do they have? So on and so forth. that is reflected in a non-weighted criteria, right? So the dot placement isn't necessarily affected by it, but what it is affected by is the there's a different dot size. So the bigger the company, the larger the dot. So they both try to take into account some element of the firm in addition to the offering, but they just take a different approach at it.
Got it. And what does this process look like from a vendor side? So I'm sure, you know, people like me have complained publicly about how much work is required. And I shouldn't say complaining. I mean, it's they're doing their jobs, right? They're evaluating the product of the company. But I mean, realistically, for an ISV or an SI, how much work is required to actually do this?
Right. So during the evaluation process itself, once you get the invitation to try to qualify through the whole entire submission process, out the fact check and into the publication, that process is, think of it like pursuing an RFP, right? So you have a customer, you have a prospect that's come to you. They've said, hey, this is my evaluation process. And it's pretty similar, honestly. They say, I would like for you to give me some information to tell whether I want to have you in the evaluation. I'm going to send you the RFP so you can respond. Then I'm going to have you come in and do a demo. So in order for me to evaluate it, and then I'll make a decision. So from an effort perspective, it's very similar to a competitive RFP. So the resources wise, it's similar, right? And honestly, I really, the one thing that I have to recommend to your listeners is spend the time. Leave no stone unturned. Accuracy matters. Make sure you take the time in the evaluation process to answer thoughtfully. Make sure you provide the evidence that you feel is that would be beneficial and would prove the claims that you're making. And just be thoughtful about, hey, listen, I've only got so much time in front of the analyst. I only have so many words that I can write. Let me be thoughtful so that it reflects the who we are and the momentum that we have and the capabilities and differentiators that I have. So take the moment to do that. Treat it like an RFP. Treat it seriously. And I think things will go pretty well for you.
So just between the three of us, and please, everybody who's listening, just hold your hands on your ears. How do I get better placement in the reports? Any secret tips that you can share in this small group that we have here?
Pretend we're drinking over beers right now, and back before that was all banned.
I love it. So let's talk a little bit about how to get a better score. So there is one. Just do a good job during the evaluation process itself. And that's fine, right? Everybody's going to do that. If you don't do that and you don't put your best foot forward, that's step that your dot placement's going to suffer. And that's probably, that's probably the basics. That's a starting point. But let's talk about like actually doing well, right? And moving it. You asked a little bit earlier about this qualitative, quantitative, and the grading aspects of it. Analysts are human beings, right? They're trying to say, how am I going to determine and tell the difference between the really, really great products and the products that are just okay, right? How am I going to, for each evaluation criteria, tell whether something's a five or whether something's a one? So whether they're going through the process and thinking line by line, what makes a five, what makes a one? What makes a five, what makes a one? And then beyond that, what they're trying to think through is what should be graded and what shouldn't be graded, what should be graded and what shouldn't be graded. And then on top of that, they're trying to make weighting decisions. What should get a lot of weighting and what should get a little weighting? So if you think about the evaluation criteria itself, the process of chasing a wave or magic quadrant, that's the grading. That's like going in and taking the test. That's like responding to the RFP. The analysts, after they get done writing this magic quadrant or wave, they've got somewhere between 12 and 24 months to refresh it. So this entire time after they publish it, they're thinking, did I get it right? What did I learn during the last time? How is the market changing? And how should I change my grading scale? So for those folks that are really, really good at moving, getting better placement, what they're really doing is they're spending the time with the analyst to say, you know what, last time you graded this, but I think that this was underweighted. More people have this problem than you think. Last time you graded this as a five, but I don't think that that's actually right, right? And let me tell you why. So those people who are really, really great at moving dots are interacting with the analysts on an ongoing basis, sharing the things that they're seeing in the marketplace, sharing the strategies and why they're making decisions that they're making, talking about the roadmap and seeing how those things are coming to life, sharing what's happening with the customers to say, these are the things that my customers and prospects are asking me. Are you seeing the same things? So you talked a little bit right off the get-go about being human, this idea of give and get. The real winners, the people who are remarkable at building this analyst relationship in order to move their dot, are people who are talking shop before the wave or magic quadrant kicks off. They're the ones who are the most useful to that analyst and providing the most data and the most perspective. So some people say, can I walk in there with $1 million and buy it a better dot? Absolutely not. But can you come in there with your perspective and your wisdom and what you see in the marketplace and share that in order to adjust how the analyst sees the marketplace so that you're more simpatico? The answer is yes. That's how you move your dot.
And kind of a related question, why do legacy vendors do so amazingly well in these reports? what's the secret? Or what's the
that's the $50,000 question. That's a $65,000 question. I can't remember the game show. But the premise there is, so they're trying to evaluate, right? X axis, Y axis. If you think about like the X axis along this vision, in reality, what ends up happening is that X axis is about vision, but it's also about provable vision, right? How do you see the marketplace? And have you built all the capabilities to match how you see the marketplace? The legacy vendors have simply had more time to either build it or buy it, right? So they have more stuff that they do. So on the x-axis, they end up with more stuff that they do. The y-axis, this idea of current offering or the ability to execute, what they're looking for is proof, right? How many places in the world have you actually done this thing? So the legacy vendors just have a preponderance of proof. They have more implementations. They have more global coverage. More of the Forrester and Gartner's customers call them and ask them about it. So what ends up happening is that the wave and magic quadrant end up being proxies for how much stuff do you do and how many places have you done it. So that's why they end up in the upper right-hand quadrant, because of the evaluation has a tendency to evaluate, to reward these things. But you know, maybe just it's interesting that we try to remind ourselves all the time. Being in the upper right-hand quadrant, right? Being in the very, very tip-top upper right-hand side, it's awesome. And I can't argue about it. Like, we're trying to help our clients move their position on a constant basis. But the reality of it is, if you are a leader or in the very, very top upper right-hand quadrant, it makes a better marketing product. It allows you to brag more. But I cannot stress enough that the evaluation criteria is only one way to grade, right? For those of you who are not in the upper right, there's still a tremendous amount of value in this report and participating in it. For one, we talked about like this 4 hours, 8 calls from a Gartner analyst in a single day. Multiply that by 5 days, 40. Multiply it by the 20 days in any month that they're working. Multiply by the quarter. Think about it. How many times are Forrester and Gartner analysts actually receiving telephone calls from people trying to make a technology decision and trying to make a buying decision, right? Even if you're not in the upper right, even if you're someplace else on the evaluative report, the analysts almost never just recommend the top. They're always saying best fit. Once one of their customers calls them up and say, help me, they're saying, what's your problem? How much budget do you have? What is your industry? What problem are you trying to solve? They really take it incredibly personally, that they make the best recommendation possible. So while the wave or magic quadrant is only a 2x2, and there's only so many winners, if you will, quote unquote winners, if you're placed, the analyst knows you. If you've done a good enough job telling the analyst what you do and who you do it best for, it's remarkable how much influence they have and how many times they can actually make a recommendation.
Okay, well said. Any final tips for vendors who are engaging with these firms, besides what we've talked about here briefly, which is study and try harder. I think just general good life.
Study and try harder. I love it. I would just say that. Oh my goodness, the humanity of it, right? The humanity of it. These are human beings, and they're analysts. The firms are The firms have a brand, and that brand gives them influence, and it gives them the soapbox and the ability to actually sort of amplify their voice. But the reality is that these are human beings. They don't like to be told, right? Going in there and making dramatic claims, you know, and we all do it. We have it in our marketing materials. We're the first, we're the best, we're the only, we're the, you know, we make these claims all the time. My recommendation is that when you're talking to an analyst who's an expert, treat them like a peer. You would never go to a peer and say that you're the best, you're the first. You would say, I see this problem and I think we're solving it in a unique way. We're investing in this way and we're trying to solve this problem either differently or leveraging a different kind of technology, right? So be willing to talk shop. Take all the different marketing claims and go ahead and throw them out the door. Take a moment to share what you think the problem is and share what the solution is. You might, they may not always see eye to eye with you, but they also talk to a lot of other people. So my recommendations for enterprises engaging is, you know, just by nature, any evaluation only has one winner, right? That's the person in the upper right. And that's not how analysts really think about it. Take the moment, talk to them, share your vision, share how you're solving the problem. Analyst relations is a different kind of craft, right? So it's not PR, it's not generic marketing, it's not comms. Go find expertise to help you if you're struggling and you can't find a way to create that open dialogue. There are resources out there like the IIAR, which is the industry group that's always providing counsel on what are the best practices in analyst relations and how to do it right. And of course, there are firms like us who can help as well.
Great. Well, thanks for spending time with us today. We very much appreciate it. And I hope our listeners walk away with some pretty actionable advice here. So thanks so much for making sense of this world for us.
Thank you so much for having me. I really enjoyed it.
Thanks, Andrew. Thanks, everybody.